the obligation to show that the rates do not exceed the appropriate forward-looking economic costs rests on the petitioners here. You'd agree with that?
Could you cite me a specific rule where it says that?
51-505E.
May I see it, please?
Sure.
Okay, I'll agree that the incumbent like must prove to the state commission that the rates must not exceed forward-looking economic costs.
Okay. Yeah.
And do you believe that when setting those rates, the rates are set on principles of cost causation?
I believe that you have to follow the rules. I don't recall any place in the rules that it says following cost causation principles.
Well, you agree with me that you look for usage sensitive charges for switching, correct?
In the case of termination rates, you can only charge traffic sensitive or usage sensitive costs.
Right. And those usage-sensitive costs are the costs associated with termination.
For termination rates, correct.
For the termination component, correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we can why don't we stay with termination for a while versus transport?
Okay.
And you would agree those are the two components that issue here is termination and then transport, correct?
Yes, to my knowledge.
On usage-sensitive costs, Mr. Weber has testified that there are some components of the switch that are not usage-sensitive in his pre-filed. Have you ever looked at his pre-filed testimony?
I did not review Mr. Weber's testimony.
Okay. This is Ms. Weiss, I don't know what the commission's preference would be. I do have an exhibit that was pre-filed with Mr. Weber's testimony. I have extra copies I could hand out so they wouldn't have to dig it out of his testimony that I just want to refer to with this witness.
Would the commissioners like copies of the exhibits if they have copies, or you just want to look them up?
Okay. The
And I believe all of Mr. Weber's testimony was filed as confidential, so I'm not sure what.
Yes,
maybe that exhibit wasn't, but.
Yeah, I took it off what they provided. It wasn't individually marked confidential, but I did confidential. I wasn't going to mark it. I was just going to refer to it as Mr. Weber's exhibit number for purposes of the record. If preference is going to mark it as an individual exhibit, I'll do that.
That's up to you.
Let's just go with it as I refer to it as Mr. Weber's exhibit.
And what was the number again?
It's Weber exhibit NWD4, and I'm using the McCook exhibit.
Okay.
And this exhibit would contain confidential information.
Is there a need for us to go off the web? Are you going to be talking about specific numbers here?
I don't believe I'll be talking about specific numbers. I'll be talking just about specific descriptions.
Ms. Moore, did we need to go off?
As long as we're not referencing the specific dollar amounts that would be in the far right and you're just using basic descriptions, no, we do not.
Okay, proceed.
Thank you. Um, Mr. Weber's testimony said that the trunk interface, line interface, and line card are non-usage sensitive. Would you agree with that?
Yes, if Mr. Weber said that was the case, then I'd agree with him.
Okay, well, can you tell me why the line interface would be non-usage sensitive?
Because once a line card is assigned to a subscriber, that subscriber either uses it or doesn't use it.
As I understand it, and I believe as Mr. Weber, his pre-filed kind of explains it, is that subscriber could use it 1 minute a day or 1,000 minutes a day. There's 1,000 minutes a day, I believe. And there's no additional cost.
In the case of a line card, once it's assigned and the subscriber's paying for it, then the cost has been recovered.
Okay. The and usage does not matter. It doesn't cause any additional cost to the LEC.
Well, the cost is covered in paying for the line card interface. And the line card interface is priced so that it would recover all the cost of the usage.
I want to ask you a couple, and I know that you're not the, what I would call the technical witness on this, but obviously you are familiar with the industry. Are you familiar with the size of these switches and the amount of traffic these switches can handle?
Not in any great detail, no.
Okay. Let me mark a... This is information taken from the MetaSwitch website and describes the switches that are at question here that are used in the forward-looking economic cost methodology. At the bottom on the right-hand side, it talks about how much support they have for busy hour attempts and subscriber lines. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
And how many subscriber lines does one of these switches support?
15,000.
And how many busy hour call attempts does it support?
250,000.
Okay. Are you familiar with any of these RLECs as to how many subscriber lines they have total? Any one of them?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you exactly, no.
Okay. Well, I believe the record would reflect the petitioners still on the case, none of them exceed 3,000 subscriber lines.
Okay.
So you'd agree with me that this, and most of these petitioners have multiple switches.
I'm not aware of their switch configuration.
Well, if they have, let's take McCook. If McCook has six switches, they would actually have capacity for 75,000 subscriber lines on these switches, correct?
I'm sorry, repeat the number of switches again.
Six.
No, six times 15,000 is not 75,000.
It's actually higher than that?
Yes, I believe it's 90,000.
90,000. Thank you. So they'd have capacity for 90,000, and you'd have capacity of 1.5 million busy hour call attempts. Maybe I hope
yes,
I did that
yes.
math right.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I understand your testimony as pre-filed, is, well, let's back up. When you buy the switch, you pay, I'm going to refer back to Mr. Weber's Exhibit D4, you buy all of this functionality and all of the equipment listed in this exhibit, correct?
I assume so. I'm not the expert on buying a switch.
Okay. If you assume that you buy all that, you pay all that up front.
Okay.
So if you have already bought all of this and the capacity is such for 3,000 subscribers, you're never going to use up the quantity of information, or, I mean, use up the switch. You're never going to exceed capacity. I understand your testimony is the additional calls coming through are still usage sensitive.
My testimony is that the FCC has defined additional cost as TELRIC plus a reasonable allocation of forward-looking common costs. So the FCC has defined additional cost as TELRIC. I feel that you're trying to twist the FCC's definition.
That's interesting because I feel you're trying to, too. The FCC has set the standard on usage sensitive. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so usage sensitive has to mean something. It has to mean that usage actually causes a cost. Wouldn't you agree?
You have to size the switch to account for usage.
And do you know whether there's any smaller switches these companies could use?
No, I'm not a switch expert, as I said before.
Okay. Well, obviously, the size of these switches greatly exceeds any demand on capacity that's ever going to exist for these companies over the life of the switch. Wouldn't you agree?
Objection, Foundation.
Oh. Is this me?
You've been an expert in this industry for how long?
I've worked in the industry for 23 years. I can't say that I've worked with the network components for that amount of time.
Okay. But you're testifying that you've rendered an opinion that the forward-looking cost analysis completed here meets FCC requirements?
Yes.
Okay. But now you're, according to... it would appear that you can't tell me whether the switch is capable of handling the amount of calls or any demand on capacity.
Well, my understanding from Mr. Weber is that they've sized it appropriately. But I'm telling you, I'm not the expert. I have to rely on the expert to tell me if that's correct.
So, let's assume it's been sized appropriately, but there's no additional cost incurred to switch a call. In that situation, is the switch usage sensitive?
Yes. Because according to the FCC's definition of additional cost, it's TELRIC, and you size the switch for usage, so it's usage sensitive.
Well, you've read Mr. Conwell's testimony in this case, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Conwell has stated that the base switch that they've sized for is so large, there's absolutely no way they're going to exceed the capacity on the switch during the life of the switch. Correct?
I believe that's what Mr. Conwell has asserted, yes.
So, going away from whether they size the switch appropriately, from an economic standpoint, is there any additional cost incurred for switching one more minute beyond what the telcos, what the Lex already switch?
Yes, according to the FCC's rules, yes.
So what rule does the FCC say that for termination, usage sensitive, there's a cost in addition to usage sensitive switching?
It is usage sensitive switching because the switch was sized to account for the usage. We're talking about capacity here. If the switch wasn't sized for usage, we wouldn't even have to be using the term capacity, and can the switch handle the number of calls? That tells you right there it's usage sensitive.
So your definition of usage sensitive is just if the switch has capacity that's never going to be exceeded, any extra cost or any extra calls are by definition usage sensitive because the switch is properly sized.
Well, if the switch is usage sensitive because you have to size it for the number of calls.
Well, then what happens if the switch is way too big for the number of calls? Is it no longer usage sensitive?
No, because you had to account for the number of calls in sizing it. I mean, I don't know what size of switch. I don't know if there was a smaller switch that could have accounted for all these calls, but you have to size for the number of calls, and actually in a forward-looking economic cost study, it would be appropriate to size it for so that it would account for all the calls and not exhaust, because the whole idea is to try and get your network sized so that it's capable of future demand.
Let's return to Mr. Weber's D4 exhibit. The first line talks about, it's right in front of you there, see it, talks mm-hmm. about a call agent.
Mm-hmm.
What does the call agent do?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with exactly every processor in the switch.
Okay. Yesterday you talked about the Eighth Circuit case coming out of Nebraska. Are you familiar with cases that have found that there are no usage-sensitive costs related to switching on switches?
I believe Mr. Conwell cited some in his testimony. I didn't go and research them in any great detail.
Well, so you didn't look at the FCC decision, or not the full FCC, but the Competition Bureau's decision finding that there is no, that buying the switch and everything that comes with the switch is just part of the getting started costs?
Could you tell me what the name of that arbitration is?
It's commonly referred to as the Virginia decision. It came out of Virginia and discussed the fact that it was a finding. I've got the full decision here if you'd like to look at it. Have you ever looked at it?
Cited Mr. Conwell's testimony?
I've glanced at it. I haven't read it in detail.
So your opinion, if this decision says the purchase of a switch and the material that come with it is just part of the getting started cost, that is opposite to the opinions you're rendering.
I'm going to object to the form of the question. I'm also going to object to foundation, and I'm not sure without having read the case and having everyone had an opportunity to review it if what's being cited is an accurate conclusion.
I think he prefaced it with, if it says, so I will overrule the objection.
Would you repeat the question, please?
If the determination was in this decision that I've cited, and it's 18 FCCR 17722, is that the purchase of the switch is just part of the getting started cost, and thus there's no usage sensitive component. That would be 180 degrees opposite of your opinion here today.
I'm not sure exactly what the FCC means by getting started costs.
You cited to the Eighth Circuit case on Nebraska where they, an arbitrary and capricious standard said that they weren't going to reject Nebraska's conclusion. Have you read the Eighth Circuit case out of Minnesota where the Minnesota Public Commission decided there was no cost in switching?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so your opinion as to the impact of the Eighth Circuit case out of Nebraska is only, you haven't done any extra research to see what other cases have decided.
I believe the Nebraska decision is correct.
Well, do you believe the Eighth Circuit was correct when they upheld the Minnesota Public Commission's determination that there was zero cost in switching?
Since I'm not familiar with the details of the case, I can't render an opinion on it.
As I understand your testimony, you claim the switch is not a fixed cost.
I don't believe that the issue here is whether we're talking about a fixed or variable cost.
Well, but that seems to be, the whole question here is whether something's usage sensitive. So are you telling me that fixed costs are usage sensitive?
Well, as I said before, the FCC's rule is for additional cost is TELRIC, and you've sized the switch to account for the usage, so it is usage sensitive.
Back again to what I call the Virginia decision. On paragraph 463, can you read the first couple lines of that out loud, please?
We conclude above, for purposes of determining the appropriate switch discount, that the getting started cost of the switch is a fixed cost, meaning that it does not vary with the number of ports or the level of usage on the switch. Is that what you want?
Yes. So let me ask it this way then. Do you agree with that statement?
Since I'm not familiar with the details of the case, I don't want to render an opinion one way or the other.
Well, I'm asking you if you, well, let me just make it simplistic. Do you agree that the switch is a fixed cost?
Once again, I don't see the relevance because TELRIC does not talk about fixed or variable costs.
You got your testimony in front of you?
Okay.
Page 3, please. You cite to 47 U.S.C. 252 D2.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the double little I towards the bottom,
mm-hmm.
It reads, such terms and conditions determine such costs on the basis of a reasonable approximation of the additional cost of terminating such calls.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the switch is so massive that there's actually no additional cost to terminate a call, why would this switch, all these switch costs, be included in the termination charge here?
because the FCC has defined additional costs as TELRIC, and the switch is sized for the USID, so it's USID sensitive. But you have to remember, additional costs are TELRIC. That's the way the FCC has codified this. This is actually out of the Act, and that's the way the FCC's come up with the rule to implement the Act.
The so as I just so I can understand where your testimony is, you're not holding yourself out as an expert on how the switch works or how any of these components that are in Mr. Weber's exhibit work.
That's correct.
It's essentially your testimony that because the switch exists and the switch is necessary to terminate traffic, it is a usage-sensitive cost.
Well, there's as I believe as Mr. Weber and some others have explained, there are certain things they take into account to make sure that the switch is appropriately sized for the usage. So that part of it's usage sensitive.
So when you talk about incremental costs, would you agree with me that if the switch is, there's no additional cost to terminate a call from Western, like out-of-pocket cost after you've invested in a switch, that there's no incremental cost for that call?
No, not according to the TELRIC rules, because it's total. It's not looking at an increment of one call. It's looking at the total number of calls and minutes.
So does it matter to you at all whether the switch is so large it can actually handle all demand, in fact, potentially clearly handle all demand that's going to be made on the switch during the life of the switch?
Well, actually, as I testified before, I believe that it should be actually sized that way, because that would be the efficient sizing to make sure that it could handle all demand. It's possible that you could actually have a greater cost if you size the switch too small and then had to augment it or replace it. So actually, that would be the efficient way of doing it, and TELRIC is based on efficiency.
Agree with me that retail costs and revenues to subsidize other services are supposed to be excluded from TELRIC?
Retail costs, like, are we talking marketing, billing, those kind of things?
Well, retail costs, wouldn't the Centrix license be a retail cost? That's a service that the LEC is providing or offering to their clients?
No, that is a retail service. That is not a retail cost. I believe the FCC has clearly defined retail costs as billing and marketing.
How about the
You don't have Rule 5 in front of you.
No, I don't.
I'm just going to ask you to read what the D2 that talks about retail costs.
Okay.
What is the entire citation?
4751505D2.
Thank you.
Retail costs include the cost of marketing, billing, collection, and other costs associated with offering retail telecommunications services to subscribers who are not telecommunications carriers described in Part 51609.
Okay. And can you cite me to a decision where the FCC has determined that it only restricted the marketing, billing, and collection, and that other costs associated with offering retail telecommunications services that would include a special software to offer a special service to their end customers?
Well, what I'm going to say is that I'm not aware of that decision, but I'm also aware that the FCC requires that the switching element offer all the functionality of switching. And if a switch has Centrex, then you would need to offer that functionality as part of the switching.
But we're looking at a termination charge here.
Termination is the same as switching in terms of the FCC's unbundled network elements.
And that goes to the UNI. I believe you're in the opening. You yesterday you stated that the methodology of Telerik is the same methodology used in unbundled networks, or the commonly referred to as UNI.
Yes, that's correct. The FCC adopted the same pricing standards.
Do you know of any decision or citation that says switching union is the same thing as termination?
Well, all I know is that the FCC defined the unbundled network elements, and I think that the two are synonymous.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I believe that the switching and the termination are synonymous.
In Mr. Conwell's testimony, he also talks about an additional cable network, cable distance in the case of West River that you take exception with. Do you recall that?
Not exactly. Could you provide me some additional detail?
Yeah. In your rebuttal, I believe, at page 12, line 3. Excuse me, I'm going to look at it. You talk about recovery of transport costs for RLX, and that it should include the entire transport network they have. Am I correct?
Yes, because the TELRIC stands, the T stands for total, so you need to include the entire cost of all the network element in computing the cost.
But if a network from RLEC has a cable that uses for some independent operation that isn't used for termination, isn't used for transport of anybody else's calls, wouldn't the inclusion of that cable be actually subsidizing other services?
I'm not aware of the use of the cable. I assume that it's associated with the transport network, and if it is, then it should be included.
Okay. If when you say transport network, you're meaning the transport network that would be open to any other carrier to carry traffic over or terminate over?
Well, transport for purposes of either transport and termination as in a proceeding like this, or transport as an unbundled network element.
CFR 701C, definition of transport.
For purposes of this subpart, transport is the transmission and any necessary tandem switching of telecommunications traffic subject to section 251B5 of the Act from the interconnection point between the two carriers to the terminating carrier's end office switch that directly serves the called party or equivalent facility provided by a carrier other than an incumbent LEC.
If there's a cable that the, for whatever reason, the LEC has established that's not between those two points, would it be included for the purposes?
Well, I believe a lot of transport is designed as a ring, so just because it's not the distance between two points, if it's part of the total transport network, yes, it should be included.
Well, if it's not in the ring, if it's an offshoot that they're using to do LEC, individual LEC activities on, it's not available for transport to other people.
I'm not familiar with the details of the network, so I can't render an opinion on what its use is.
Yeah, and I'm not asking you to do that. I'm saying is there comes a point where a LEC might have a transport facility that they're using proprietary. Are you saying that that needs to be included?
Well, let me put it this way. My understanding of Mr. Conwell's testimony was that he objected because he thought Alltel would not be using that route, and that's not an appropriate basis for an objection, because if it's the route's being used for transport, then it should be included.
Okay. I want you to read the next definition on termination.
Okay. Do you want me to read it out loud? For purposes of this subpart, termination is the switching of telecommunications traffic at the terminating carrier's end office switch or equivalent facility and delivery of such traffic to the called party's premises.
Do you know whether, and again, this might be better for Mr. Weber, but given your experience, do you know whether the web self-care is used in the switching? It's a component of the...
Well, it must be a component of the switch because it shows up on this exhibit, let me say that much.
Yeah, but the definition doesn't say what's the component or what's maybe the add-ons. It's what's used in switching, correct?
Well, I guess using the switch means that you're using all the components of the switch, or you could be.
Well, if there's a component of the switch that's not used in the actual switching of a call, should it be excluded?
I don't understand why you would have a component of a switch and it's not used for a call.
Well,
why is it even there?
Well, I'm not asking you to understand how the switch works or what components can be added to a switch that have nothing to do with actual switching. What I'm asking is if a component of the switch, under the definition that you just read,
mm-hmm.
is not used in the switching, it should be excluded in the cost.
No, because once again, the switching element, it includes all the functionality of the switch.
But, so if Arlec wants to add on a bunch of software onto the switch that has nothing to do with switching, that gets added on to the cost Alltel has to pay to switch.
Well, I'm not the expert on what in the switch does and doesn't control the switching, so I can't tell you that.
Yeah, well, so that you're offering an opinion to this commission that everything on the switch should be included as switching cost.
Well, I'm assuming that everything you put on the switch is used for some purpose or another within the switching element.
Okay, so I go back to my question. If it is not used as part of the switching element, it should be excluded under the definition of the switching as set forth by the FCC.
Objection asked and answered.
Well, my answer is the same. I don't understand why you would have something on a switch if it isn't used for switching.
Now I got to go back again. The fact that you don't understand is not the question. The question is, if it's not used for switching, you would agree, according to the definition you just read, it should not be included.
No, because there are things in the switch that have switching functionality that need to be included, because they could be needed for if someone wants to get the switching unbundled network element, they may need some of that functionality.
If they don't need it, well, if you don't need it for termination, you can have. Would you agree at least that there can be things in the switching network that are not necessary for termination?
I don't believe it matters, because it's basically you're gonna price the switching, and if you don't price all the switching things in, then as I pointed out in my testimony, according to Section 252I, another carrier could come and opt into this agreement and basically be paying for something and not really paying for the total cost, because you excluded part of it in this proceeding.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what you say, but you don't, if no CLEC is going to come in and opt into this agreement and be able to use other elements of the switch, because this agreement only provides for termination. Doesn't allow them to ride on their switch or substitute into their switch.
This agreement, in my understanding, applies to transport and termination.
Okay, for transport, fair, but we're talking about switch right now.
Okay.
So if a CLEC comes in, the CLEC is going to want more than just termination if they're going to want to use this switch.
I can't speculate on a CLEC's business plan.
But you just speculated that a CLEC could come in and take advantage of this. You just speculated on what a CLEC could do.
Objection argumentative.
Sustained.
So if you're not going to speculate on a CLEC, then how do you know what a CLEC would do or want, or whether a CLEC would be interested in this termination rate in any case?
Well, I'm just saying if the agreement is out there, other carriers can opt into the agreement. That's part of the law.
But you're not rendering an opinion on what rights that grants the carrier. It just grants them the exact same rights that Alltel would have. You'd agree with that?
Well, it allows them to get that same agreement.
Right.
The same terms and rates in that agreement.
termination, a right to termination at a certain rate, and transport at a certain rate.
Whatever the agreement specifies.
Again, I let's just make sure that Mr. Weber's exhibit, you can't tell me whether a wireless carrier terminating uses any of it, what's been marked in the category designated as common.
Well, I would assume since it's marked common that, that they must at least use some of it, because I don't know how the call would get terminated if it didn't use some of the common equipment.
Okay. You don't know whether they use the Centrex or the web self-care or anything like that.
I'm not familiar with every individual component of the common equipment.
You'd agree with me that the in coming up with your rates, you have to base it on a reasonable projection of the demand that would be coming along?
A forward-looking demand, yes.
Okay. And were you part of coming up or making a determination what the forward-looking demand would be in the situation?
I was not the person that actually forecast the demand.
Okay. Do you know how that demand was even forecast?
I believe it was an approximation based on current demand, but I'm not familiar with the details.
Okay. Would you agree with me that the that the growth in demand tends to be for wider and for broadband as opposed to voice lines in these areas?
I'm really not familiar with any of the individual South Dakota RLEX growth or demand patterns.
And I ask you to turn to page 5 of your testimony. Bottom of page 5, going on to page 6, you make the statement. The words incremental cost refer to additional costs a firm will incur as a result of expanding the output of a good or service by producing an additional quantity of a good or service.
Okay. Yes.
If you go out and buy the switch, and the switch has capacity to carry an additional call, let's assume a baseline of 10,000. We can assume there's 3,000 service lines, and it never needs to carry more than 1,000 calls at any one time. If one more call comes on that, but there's no more out of pocket, what's the additional cost the firm incurred?
Well, if you go back and read the previous page, it says that the TELRIC, you need to include the total demand quantity. So in this case, when you're talking about a TELRIC study, the incremental cost actually refers to the entire range of demand or the total demand. TELRIC is not measured on the basis of one additional unit, like one additional call. And TELRIC is the pricing standard.
So you go right back to, because you bought the switch, and the switch is going to be used, the switch has to be divided over all demand.
Well, the usage-sensitive portion of the switch.
Right. And if to complete the TELRIC, you would need to project future demand, and if future demand is understated, what does that do to the rate that you're asking for?
I don't know. I guess it depends on if you've assessed your costs appropriately or not. Well, there's two sides to the rate.
Right, but if your future demand is understated in calculating the rate, I mean, you're dividing, as you said, you're dividing the cost of the switch over all the demand. So if it's understated, you're overstating the cost of the demand.
Injection Foundation calls for speculation.
Overruled.
Well, hypothetically, if your costs are correct and your demand is understated, then I guess your rates could potentially, well, obviously they'd be greater than if you forecasted your demand correctly. I mean, obviously we don't know the magnitude or anything like that.
Understood. That's all I have.
Ms. Kramer? Thank you, staff has nothing. Commissioners? Any redirect? I'm sorry.
Occasionally it's best that elected official doesn't show their ignorance, but going to exercise that a little bit here. Could you explain what a TELRIC is to me? You referred to TELRIC a number of times.
Yes. TELRIC is the pricing standard that the FCC adopted for unbundled network elements and also for transfer and termination. It stands for total element long run incremental cost. It's basically an economic costing standard. And actually, I think the easiest way is to explain what each word in the term means. Total, as I've said several times today, means that when you're computing the TELRIC cost, you need to look at the entire range of demand and cost for that element. You aren't like doing a cost for, say, for example, components of the network we think Alltel might be using or not using or someone else. It's like if you want to get switching, if you want to get transport, you look at the LEX entire network and all their costs associated with that element, and that goes into the TELRIC calculation. E stands for element, and in this case we're looking at the transport and termination elements is what we're pricing in this proceeding. L means long run. And that is a period of time in which all of the firm's costs become variable or avoidable. And basically what that means is you're sizing it out long enough so that all of your equipment would become obsolete. So you're basically trying to right-size your equipment and your network to take care of your basically your forward-looking demand. And then finally, the words incremental cost refer to the additional costs that you would incur as a result of expanding your output of a service. But as I said before, the incremental cost, you have to look at that over the total cost of the element, the total range of demand. It's not just like looking at one additional unit. It's looking at the total, all the switching demand, all the transport demand.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any redirect? Just one question. Ms. Vandercheck, there was some discussion over whether certain portions of transport or certain other elements should be parsed out from the total costs that go into the development of the study. What's the FCC's statement regarding how the cost of shared facilities, and why is that important?
The FCC has indicated that when you have shared facilities, it's important that the cost should be apportioned in a manner that efficiently allocates those costs among users. So, say, for example, in the case of a switch, if you have someone using the switch and they aren't paying for it, I would say that that is an efficient apportionment of cost, because if some people are paying and others aren't, obviously that sends the wrong pricing signal to the people that are getting it for free. They're thinking, gee, I can use this all I want and I never have to pay for it, whereas others pay for it. And then that basically messes, from an economist standpoint, that messes up your resource allocation, because you've got some people paying that are actually paying too much and others that aren't paying enough because they aren't paying anything. So it's important when you have a shared resource that you share those costs among all the users of the resource.
Thank you, Ms. Vandercheck. I have nothing further.
Any further cross? Oh, thank you, Ms. Vandercheck.
You're welcome.
Can we call your next witness, Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Ms. Moore. The petitioners would call Mr. Nathan Weber. Please introduce yourself to the commission.
Yes, my name is Nathan Weber, and my business address is 2211 North Minnesota Street in Mitchell, South Dakota.
And by whom are you employed, Mr. Weber?
I serve as the Director of Engineering for Vantage Point Solutions. Vantage Point is an engineering and consulting firm based out of Mitchell, South Dakota. We focus primarily on rural independent telecommunications service providers. Currently, Vantage Point has approximately 80 full-time staff members on staff, of which approximately 20 are within the engineering group.
And what are your responsibilities as the Director of Engineering?
I am responsible for conducting the design and implementation of many telecommunications networks for rural service providers, as well as managing members of the engineering staff.
And can you provide the commission with your educational background, please?
Certainly. I attended South Dakota State University, from which I graduated with highest honors with a degree in electrical engineering. And upon completion of my education, I signed on with a company called Martin & Associates, which also performs engineering consulting services. I worked there as a member of the engineering staff for a few years, and I resigned from that position to take a position as a senior engineering staff member for Vantage Point Solutions, and have subsequently been promoted to the Director of Engineering.
On whose behalf have you provided direct and rebuttal testimony in this particular matter?
I have provided testimony on behalf of the petitioners, which include Kennebec, McCook, Santel, and West River.
And what was the purpose of your testimony?
The purpose of my testimony was essentially to provide some of the engineering design for the forward-looking model, as well as the cost estimates for the various components included in the engineering design. I provided that detailed information to Consortia Consulting and worked directly with them to help them to make sure they understood the engineering parameters and the components of the various devices so that they could appropriately allocate the investments.
When we talk about the FLEX study itself and your responsibility in assisting to develop that, can you talk with the commission a little bit about the FLEX study and what are the categories of investments to be included in that FLEX study that you were responsible for developing?
Certainly. You know, as an overview, there are really three main categories of investments that we included and provided to Consortia for the purposes of the FLEX model. That includes the outside plant cable construction, essentially what this is the fiber optic cable routes that would connect between the various exchanges of the various central offices for these telephone companies. In addition to that, the second component would be the inter-exchange transport electronics. These are essentially the electronics that are placed within the central office to transport traffic between them, utilizing the fiber optic cable as the transport mechanism. And the third and final component would be the switching investment. So this is the voice switching electronics that would be located within each central office.
Okay, let's talk about the first component that you mentioned, which would be the outside plant. Can you talk about the outside plant, the cable, and what considerations you look at in determining what should be included?
Certainly, there were several main design parameters that we included when we designed the fiber optic outside plant cable investment. First was we utilized ring architectures to connect the various exchanges together. And the reason why we used survivable ring architectures was to be in accordance with South Dakota Codified Law 49-31-60. In addition, in order to maintain the most efficient routes, with regards to the rings to connect these various locations, we took the most probable and direct routes, assuming public right-of-way. So any existing roadways were typically the routes that we followed for this construction. The reason why public right-of-ways were used is because it is more efficient, it is less costly than trying to purchase and procure private right-of-way for the cable construction.
In this particular case, I believe you prepared a handout and a poster board that you'd like to show to the commission to help illustrate that. Is that correct?
Certainly. I'd like to introduce a poster board. I believe it was referenced in my direct testimony as NW-D-8. And what this particular example provides detail on is really the components of the outside plant cable investment and some of the various items that were included in that. With regards to the investment, we divided out the costs into rural construction costs as well as town construction costs. Because as it's most likely obvious to the commission, the cost for constructing in a town environment is greater than what it would cost in the rural environment because you're dealing with paved roads, you're dealing with curb and gutter, storm sewers, and various other impediments. So when we look at the components on this particular diagram, I show in the center what's referred to as Town B in a central office that's located there. And if we just describe real briefly, moving from that central office to the right towards Town C, we'll describe the components that are included in that outside plant cable investment. Within the town, coming out of that central office, you have a building entrance. So this is the construction requirement to actually bring the cable within the building, to conduct any splicing of that fiber optic cable, and have it prepared for termination to the inter-exchange transport electronics. In addition to that, you actually have the construction of the mainline cable through town, as well as any splicing associated with that construction. Once we leave the city limits or area of population density that would be consistent with a town environment, we would get to what's shown here in red as the rural fiber routes. And typically, as I stated before, these are lower cost environments to construct cable in. And we include various splice points within this route as well. Typically speaking, when you're talking about especially rural construction, you'll have a splice point approximately every 3 miles, just due to the fact that that's the standard increments that reels of fiber optic cable come in. So about every 3 miles, we have splicing that occurs along this route. At this far end, we once again come into another town where we have town construction, additional splicing, and what's not shown on the very right-hand side of this is really the corresponding building entrance that would be in the central office in what's referred to as Town C.
For purposes of the record, this poster board that Nathan is referring to was attached to his direct testimony as NW-D-8. We've marked it as Exhibit 12 and would offer that for the record.
Any objection? Right. Is there a reason you want it in twice?
The exhibits are identical for all of the companies, and if we filed it with testimony, it would be six sets of testimony about, or five sets, excuse me, that would be about that thick. So what I have anticipated doing is, since these are identical for all of the companies, mm-hmm. offering them as individual exhibits, so we wouldn't have six different sets of record plus another set.
Okay. Exhibit 12 is admitted.
Mr. Weber, you've talked about this diagram a bit. Can you tell us how you determined the unit investments for both the town and the rural outside plant construction and estimates? And let's talk about Kennebec.
Okay, with regards to Kennebec, to describe the unit investments and how we developed the unit investments for both the town and rural construction, I'd first like to start with the town construction. And for that, I want to refer to an exhibit that I provided in my direct testimony, which was exhibit NW-D-9.
And I believe this exhibit is confidential. Is that correct, Mr. Weber?
That is correct. This includes confidential information.
You need to be off the record, that one.
Are you going to be discussing any confidential information at this time?
We'll be discussing pricing information for various existing networks, so I feel that it would be appropriate to be not broadcast.
Okay. At this point, I believe we need to go off.